Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 198th video cast, 188th podcast for the week ending August 3rd, 2023. Welcome, welcome, welcome. As always, click on terms at hedgefundtips.com. This is opinion, not advice. And we're going to kick it off with the kids this week. We had a big week all around, and just to get the summary here, first and foremost, Mimi, our eldest, went to the Junior Olympics in Texas last week. She just got back, and their team won the gold at Junior Olympics, which is pretty exciting. That was her first Junior Olympics tournament. She had five goals throughout the multiple games that they played throughout that tournament. And Annabelle is now in Virginia for zones, and she swam all lightning fast personal bests at the Eastern Zone Championships in Virginia and made the podium in 50 meter and 100 meter backstroke, as well as medaled in all four relays. And then just in their 400 free medley relay team just won the gold. So that's the latest. Very exciting stuff. For those of you who've been following, I'd like to share that stuff. The other thing that was not noted here is in the club championships for counties on Monday, Annabelle broke Gretchen Walsh's 8-under 25 fly record of 16.56. with 16.28. Now, why does that matter? Because Gretchen Walsh is the she achieved her first spot at a national competition for juniors when she was 12 years old. She became the youngest swimmer to qualify for the 2016 Olympic trials in 2016 at just 13 years of age. She was also the youngest swimmer to compete at the Olympic trials 13 years, 4 months, and 13 days old at the time of competition. So she's on to, I think, University of Virginia, superstar swimmer. So real honor for Annabelle to have that accomplishment. And she's now at University of Virginia. I guess she'll be competing at the Olympics in Paris next summer. We have tickets for that, but now it looks like there's Junior Olympics. We'll figure it out. Anyway, got Annabelle out on the golf course while Mimi was in Texas. That's her with the dragonfly on the driving range. Pretty upright, steep swing. We're going to work on that and shallow that out a little bit. But this looks really, really darn good at setup from what I can see. And some of you pros, a little bit too much sway there. We'll try to keep some of that weight forward. Some wild turkeys. Moving right along. Oh, this is one of her medals from, I guess, in the last 24 hours. And that's that. So let's get right down to it. First, I want to thank Charles Payne, Kayla Aristivo, Nick Palazzo for having me on Fox Business this week. Making money with Charles Payne. Always love going on with Charles. And we're going to click into that because we cover kind of the playbook for the second half. We cover Alibaba. We cover some key points and how dumb money has become the new smart money. So go ahead and listen in here.
Hey, let's bring in Great Hill Capital Chairman Thomas Hayes. All right, Thomas, Goldman Sachs indicating that there's a lot of capitulation amongst hedge funds. You follow hedge funds, you know all about it. First of all, do you see this capitulation yourself? And what does it mean for the market?
Well, this is very similar to the COVID lows in 2020. The smart money is wrong once again, and everyone's saying the dumb money has been buying this rally. The dumb money has been buying this rally. They bought it from March of 2020 to June of 2020, and then the institutions had to chase up after the market was already up 30-40%. We're seeing the exact same thing off the October lows from last year. Actually, the dumb money, the retail, has been right. They've been buying the whole way up, and the institutions are going to have to put this money into cash. Now, they're not going to chase those things that are up huge. The Magnificent Seven, I think, are going to cool down, consolidate. It doesn't mean they have to crash, but there's a lot to do under the surface where they can play catch up.
And by the way, the dumb money, in the meantime, have been buying things like Tupperware at 60, and now it's at $6.
Yeah.
You know, listen, we kind of have fun with this, but we also do it for a reason, because you know, the narrative is always, you know, one that, hey, the folks on the street always get it right and the folks at home don't always get it right. Yeah. And for the last few years, it's been topsy-turvy, the exact opposite. Yeah. I want to now specifically focus on what you're looking at. For the second half of the year, you've got certain themes. You've got rotation, weak dollar, interest rates. Talk to us how this translates into where we should be in the stock market.
Yeah, no question. So the two key themes are weak dollar and a bid in the 10-year, which means yields compress. So on the weak dollar, you want to be in multinationals that have 50% or more of their revenues
abroad. Can a name like Caterpillar that reported this morning count for that?
Certainly that counts as that. You've got, believe it or not, you got PayPal, you've got Intel, you've got Baxter, you've got companies like that that do a lot of their business abroad. But I think where the real relative outperformance is going to be, you know, I love the most hated stuff, Charles, I'm in here, is going to be in emerging markets. And emerging markets is 40% China. And I know people don't love it. I know that government's been sitting back. Come on, give me the stimulus.
They haven't given the stimulus.
But like all politicians, they make the right decision after exhausting all other possibilities. And they're getting to the point where they're going to have to pull out the bazooka. And they can do it because they don't have inflation. That's coming. You're going to see huge bid in emerging markets the second half. That's going to be the catch-up. And you know we love BABA. I told you last time to buy it under 100. We got over 100. And I think the next stop is 120.
All right. Well, a lot of fits and false starts with those Chinese names.
Yeah.
Maybe you're saying maybe this time around works out.
Yeah.
Thomas, great stuff. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Also remember.
And we're back. And while we're doing that, just in the context of China, because we only got to touch on it briefly, it was a short segment, I want to bring on today, we had the CEO of Wyndham talking about China on CNBC, and this confirms everything we saw with the June holidays and what we're going to be seeing in earnings in just short order. Very, very exciting stuff. So let's listen in.
I see what you're saying. Kind of people want this to be, okay, we're back to 2019 levels or even better in some cases. Let's talk China, if we can, for a second. What are you guys seeing there? It's been a very odd year for China so far.
Boy, but the last 6 or 7 weeks over in China have, again, been up over 19. There's still a ways to recover. I think occupancy were somewhere around 80% of the way back. International inbound is still coming into China. Domestic continues to accelerate. We had a very busy holiday season over there in May, and it's just been great to see so many consecutive weeks, both in China and in Europe and across Africa and the Middle East. That so, leisure demand continued to pick up.
And I'm trying to think of who else it was. It could have been Yum or one of the companies that recently has China exposure. Maybe it was Starbucks also saying that just really in the last kind of month or so, Chinese demand is starting to pick up. Is that what you guys are observing?
Travel demand is starting to pick up and development demand continues to pick up. It has been quarter after quarter after quarter for 2 consecutive years. Where we've seen a double-digit increase in our development pipeline and our direct franchising business. Developers over in China are just as anxious to open and develop hotels as they are here in the United States. I mean, we have had now 12 consecutive quarters of pipeline growth globally, and we're seeing that both domestically and internationally. And our developers, our owners, our small business owners believe that there's never been a better time to build a new construction prototype of ours in the economy and the mid-scale select service space because of the blue-collar everyday travel business demand that's out there than there is now. We're seeing it in China and we're seeing it here.
So,
and we're back. So despite all the negative headlines, the underlying businesses, we saw it in Starbucks, we saw it in Wyndham, we saw it in the casinos, MGM China, we saw it in the holiday numbers they're putting out, and we're going to see it in earnings shortly, and we're very excited about that. Moving along, want to go to CNA, is the top station in Singapore. It's like the BBC of Singapore and Asia, Malaysia, Singapore, and I was talking to a gentleman from Singapore who's coming in as an investor, and he said they're growing immensely over there in Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore, and that quite a few people watch it. So that was nice to see. Thanks to Olivia Marzuki, Elizabeth Ann Neo, and Marianne Star Inake for having me on. This one was extremely important because it deals with the debt downgrade, which is the topic du jour after Fitch downgraded the U.S. debt. What does that mean? And it's actually probably the opposite of what everyone is expecting. We're going to explain why here, and then we're going to flesh it out a little more. And that's especially important given there was a big name out today talking about shorting the long end of the curve while Buffett was out talking about buying the short end of the curve. And we're going to talk about what that means moving forward. So listen in here.
And Thomas Hayes, the chairman and managing member at Great Hill Capital, joins us this morning for more. Thomas, let's talk about stocks in sell-off mode following Fitch's downgrade. Could it get worse for U.S. equities, and how long could this volatility last?
Well, Liz, great to be with you. As you said, down 1.4%. But you have to put in perspective, that's after being up 31% off of the October lows, a rally that many people missed. And what we find with these type of moves that are catalyst-driven with the downgrade is that the first move is often the wrong move. Because if we look back to 2011, the last time the debt was downgraded at that point by S&P, the initial move is yield spike. But as you look out, actually, the bonds start to get bid. And in the 12 months following the downgrade in 2011, the 10-year note yield went from 3.5% down to 1.39. So that initial knee-jerk to 4.07 may in fact be the wrong move. And the move looking forward may be that people realize if the U.S. got downgraded, then what's coming next, which is what we saw last time, are there going to be European downgrades? And if there are going to be European downgrades, then the U.S. Treasury, the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, is going to look the safest, and you're going to see a compression of yields and massive demand for U.S. Treasuries just in time for the Treasury to issue $1 trillion of bonds over the next few weeks.
Yes, speaking of that, the Treasury's new borrowing plans to increase the bond sale size in order to cover that deficit. What is the impact likely to be on yields? What does this mean for markets and investors?
Well, I think prior to yesterday when Fitch downgraded the credit rating, it was a little bit interesting to see what would happen with $1 trillion of supply on the market. But I think as we saw in 2011, as people start to think about other knock-on effects, if you recall, it led to a multitude of downgrades in Europe, and Mario Draghi had to come in with his bazooka and say, we'll do whatever it takes. And I think as yields are over 4%, that seems to be the area where it starts to cause trouble and where central banks start to step in. You saw it with the pound of over a year ago and different instances where the Fed, where different central banks had to add liquidity. So I think in coming weeks, you're actually going to see after this initial knee-jerk reaction, some level of demand, which could push down yields and facilitate a more easy issuance of U.S. Treasuries. As far as the stock market, you know, you've seen many institutions, if you look at institutional positioning coming into this, the stock market was red hot, but institutions were dramatically underweight, taking risk levels at their lowest levels since the great financial crisis lows in March of 2009 and the COVID lows. So a lot of them missed this rally. So we think that on normal 3 to 5% seasonal pullbacks, we're moving into a seasonally weak period. August and September is historically weak. They're going to be met by bids from institutions trying to play catch up to their benchmarks.
And what is your overall assessment of the U.S. economy, and how have the latest developments impacted that, if at all?
Well, I think it's going to be less than people expect. If you look at the Atlanta Fed, they put out their GDP now number estimating Q3 GDP at plus 3.9%. I think very few people were looking for a plus number just a few couple of months ago. Also, we're in the middle of earnings season, and earnings are actually coming in somewhat better than expected. We're looking at estimates and guidance have been taken up to $246 for the S&P for 2024. So that was surprising to a lot of people. So earnings are holding in there. GDP is coming in better than expected. We had a hot ADP number. We'll see what the jobs number looks like. And inflation continues to come down. So the Goldilocks scenario was there.
We'll see the knock-on effects of this Fitch downgrade, but, you know, Fitch is a third-tier rating agency, so it may not be as impactful as S&P was in 2011. But we do have to keep an eye on, does it lead to other downgrades in Europe? And if so, I think the global central bankers are going to be back in action providing liquidity before we know it.
Well, many thanks for your insights this morning. Thomas Hayes there from Great Hill Capital.
And we're back. Also want to thank Akash Sriram over at Reuters for having me in his article on EVs. The basis here is I think you basically have Musk and you have the legacy OEMs, and the rest of them are really going to have trouble raising enough cash. Musk, you have a genius in perfect conditions and perfect timing in history. He was able to pull it off. The car business is a hard business. So now you've got the legacy plus Musk, and that's probably going to be most of the show. I know you'll get the headlines. Some of them will get sold for their technology, but that's a tough game to start from scratch. So everyone's now, with the debt downgrade, wanting to short the long end of the curve. Here we're looking at the 10-year note, which I'm most focused on. And what you can see, and we've covered this many times, this green line I've set up custom is the commercial hedgers. So this is the problem. A very big name hedge fund manager was out, who is quite a good stock picker, but his macro calls have been very, very mixed over the years. Leaving that aside, all we do is look at the data and forget the opinion. And what you can see here is these are the hedge funds like that headline today, and they're absolutely shorting the long end of the curve at the exact wrong time when they're all this crowded at this side of the boat. And by the way, sometimes it's to get out of a position when they would be putting out that type of headline, but I don't think that's the case in this time. But this was the exact bottom when Treasury's bottom yields peaked in November of 2018, and then bonds rallied like nobody's business. I think it's exact same thing. He came out with this huge call, and he may have actually ticked the bottom today. I don't know. I think they came off their lows. Like, if you just look simply at the TLT, we have some positioning in that in the last 24 hours. We're going long bonds. And I understand there's going to be $1 trillion of supply over the next few weeks. So it might take a month longer than I expect. But by the end of the year, it would not shock me to see this 10-year note back up to 120, even 125, but at least 115. I don't see it at 105. Maybe it goes to like 106 before it goes up to 115, 120. So be it. But when you get commercials this aggressive, commercials are always early and they're always right. And that you want to be following them when they're buyers, just like 18. Here they were buyers. Here they were buyers. Here they were buyers ahead of this big move. So that's what we're focused on is positioning, and it got a little crowded. The other thing I want to talk about here is, first and foremost, I want to thank everyone who's already come in. It's been a whirlwind 2 weeks, okay? So our existing clients who are the 5 and 10 plus million clients, we're very grateful. All the new clients that have come in at the 1 and 5 million. So first off, as always, I'm very grateful to you, and I'm very excited for you, both existing and all the new ones coming in, and the bunch that are on the waiting list to come in 6 to 8 weeks who have submitted your subscription agreements. We're very excited for that. Very excited given the opportunity set that we have right now. So thank you to Chris, Rob, Chris, Brian, Woody, Steve, John, Srini, Paul, Ed, Steve, and coming in on the wait list now, Chandra, Rich, Sandeep, James, Sean, Ajmal, Nabi, Robert, Brian, Jake, and a lot more. I know there are a bunch in the inbox. If we haven't called you back, I will get back to you over the next few days. And also, I'll be in Las Vegas on Monday, speaking Tuesday morning, back out Tuesday night. And then Cooper Standard's going to be in the city on Thursday to speak to JP Morgan. So I'll be over there on Wednesday a little early for that on my way home from Vegas. They report tonight, by the way. They usually do it at around 6 p.m. The thing I would say about Cooper Standard, you know, we've seen all the OEM numbers. I think they're going to be, the numbers are going to be fine. We saw BorgWarner. Their numbers were good. They're another auto parts supplier. And I would also say that with the conference call, they are still negotiating contracts, you know, as we know, for Europe and for the U.S. And I would think in the context of what the OEMs are doing in terms of they have negotiations with the UAW coming up here in the next few weeks. You see all the headlines are we're slashing costs, we're losing money on EVs. Poor me. Why? Because they have to negotiate with the UAW. Even though the production's through the roof and everything's humming, they don't want to be doing a victory lap right before negotiations. And I think the same will be true as we've seen on the last few conference calls. I would be very surprised, despite great numbers, if management is doing a victory lap before they tie up all of those final contracts. You know, they've gotten most of them done, but I know that they've mentioned publicly that they're negotiating additional contracts, and I would expect their enthusiasm to be subdued, even if the numbers are fantastic. So just keep that in mind. I hope that is the case, because then I can get some new clients, some Cooper Standard. We don't buy up. That's just the bottom line. We buy when things are down. So, but there are extraordinary amounts of other new opportunities at the same time. Okay, now, if you're not a client coming in or in the trade service, by the way, a lot of new people there too. Very grateful for that. The best compliment you can pay is to share this podcast with one person you know personally. If you have social media, please do that. That really helps a lot. Put comments on YouTube. Reshare it on Twitter and LinkedIn and wherever you do social media. We're very grateful for that. But the clients that are coming in who weren't referred by existing clients, because that's the first thing I ask when we talk on the phone, how'd you, you know, find out about me? If they weren't referred by existing clients, they all had a friend or family member who recommended the podcast first. And they've all been listening to the podcast, some for a couple months, some for 3+ years, and they're finally coming in, which is very exciting. So, you know, like, comment, subscribe to the YouTube channel. And that's that. So moving right along, again, it wouldn't surprise me if that big headline today of shorting the long end of the curve marks near the bottom. If it goes against us because of all the supply in the next few weeks, so be it. But you're not going to fight against this. 3-6 months out, bonds will have rallied. That is about as clear of a positioning that I know. These are things that I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at, and I'm very, very confident with that assertion. Let's just leave it at that. Okay, the other thing I want to start with context, Rob Sloomer over at RBC, we've used his notes a lot on this, and I know some of the folks over at Fox, you know, view our podcast, which we're very grateful for, and read our weekly notes, and we often feature Robert Sloomer's work in our notes and in our podcast. And today he was actually on the Charles Payne Show, so I want to play that because it gives us a framework for those of you who feel like, wow, they're having such a monster year, and that's true. You know, our legacy accounts are up big, okay, and even our new accounts that came in March are up big, and then the new accounts also. There is so much to do, but I want you to listen to the framework that we're thinking about, not the next 3 months, this, you know, seasonal choppiness, but actually how we're thinking about the next 7 to 11 years. We're just in this perfect range where there's going to be a continued tremendous amount of opportunity moving forward. And I think Robert lays it out. Now, we put this out in our own unique way in 2020. You can go back to some of our notes. We were talking about this concept, but I love how he frames it. And I want you to take a listen to this clip. He was on today on the Charles Payne Show on Fox Business. Listen here.
My next guest caught my attention with a chart title, Could the S&P Rally to 14,000? I'm going to bring in RBC Wealth Management technical strategist Rob Sloomer. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe.
First of all, let's put that chart up here because, golly, I mean, that got my attention.
It's a big number.
It's a big number. I feel like, you know, Ron Pappelli, set it and forget it. I don't even have to do this anymore.
Well, look, nobody really knows where the market's going to be far into the future, but clients are looking for some perspective on where markets could possibly go. What's the potential here?
Right.
So when we look back at the history of the market, we don't have a huge sample set, right? We have a low in 1932, and it peaked out roughly 2,300% higher in the late 60s. And we had a similar move from 74 to where we were in 2000. So we have a sample set of two. So take that with a grain of salt, right?
But they cover a large amount of years, though.
Back a large number of years, right. And there's these huge cycles that carry on through that time frame, roughly generational cycles, 16 to 18 years.
So let me just show the audience. So you're talking the 17-year cycle, folks. Over and over again, they tend to repeat themselves, Rob.
And you tend to get these major peaks in the market and bottoms around those levels. So if that pattern continues, and I do believe that markets move in cycles, whether it's very short-term or very long-term, we could see the market move higher into 2034. Now, as any strategist will tell you, never put a target and you never put a date on the same page, but we have both here. So
this 14,000, and that is that equal, this is a, that would make the 2,300 that we see here and here, is that the 23,000?
It's only about 2,000. I'm taking a conservative view.
Oh, wow. So, okay, you get a little
And you know what? The pushback's going to be that the compound annual growth rate's closer to 10%, which is a little bit above the normal mean. But markets tend to overshoot. So it's not an unreasonable target. And particularly when you look at the current uptrend is a very simplistic way of looking at it. It's not unreasonable.
What about the periods, and you kind of alluded to it, when it's not going up, these sort of periods, you know, these sort of drought type periods, those feel excruciating. I mean, a day feels like a week when those happen.
A month feels like a year.
Right. And investors are sort of like, they can't take it. You know, I mean, how do you put that in perspective?
Well, that's exactly why we want to have these long-term charts, is to keep people invested in the market for the long term. We don't think we're in one of these periods like the 70s and the early 2000s. We think we're still in another upside move. So when we do get drawdowns, even the noise that we've seen over the last couple of days, a couple of weeks, it's really important to have that longer-term perspective.
All right, so we've got the long-term perspective. Now let's figure out how to game this. Industry cycles, where are we now on this sort of on this cycle?
Great question, because if you think about those secular trends, they tend to move in 2 to 4 year moves. Right? You tend to have these 2 years up and a couple years down. We just came through this big bear market in 2022. So we've been making the case that there was a cycle low developing in the fourth quarter. And you have some groups leading. You've got semiconductors, tech and software, but you're also starting to see lots of the cyclicals starting to come on, notably in the industrial space. You talked about the repatriation of U.S. manufacturing. I think that's a very big theme here, longer term, to be considering in a portfolio.
Well, this is sort of where we are, to your point. And I know materials are really coming on strong. So as an investor, people feel like, okay, I missed these software and semis. Is it okay then to go down here as those come up?
I think you want to be selective, but I think the key point is we do have leadership in secular growth, that's technology, and we have this emergent in cyclical growth, and we want to be adding to both those themes on a pullback. As your last guest just highlighted, there's a good chance we get a bit of a pullback.
I got 30 seconds. Energy's here, sort of a wild card.
Yeah, the reason it's up there is that most of those stocks have actually gone sideways through 2022. Very volatile ranges, but they look like they're starting a new up leg. I actually like energy at these levels.
You like energy, but do you like it more than these names down here, though?
I like it more than staples, utilities, and healthcare.
Okay, so the safe havens for the most part.
Exactly.
We don't need them right now.
Not for the long term.
Okay, Robert, great stuff.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
And we're back. So if you think you missed anything, we haven't even gotten started, ladies and gentlemen. So we're very excited moving forward. As new money's come in the last 2 weeks, we've had no problem putting money to work. I mean, there are new things to do. We're going to talk about some of those today and then move from there. So let's see here. If we can get this guy going, I'm not sure what I'm missing here. Ah, here we go. Quote of the week. This is a great concept here from Peter Lynch. When stocks are attractive, you buy them. Sure, they can go lower. I've bought stocks at $12 that went to $2, but then later they went on to $30. You just don't know when you can find the bottom. Good example, that's Range Resources. And by the way, natural gas, if you look at Schlumer's most recent note, by the way, this is Alibaba. He's actually saying from a technical standpoint, contrarian bottoming pattern continues with BABA rallying above 94 resistance with 105, followed by 119 to 120. We've been talking 180. After it gets through 120. So we'll probably come up against some resistance. And the only reason we're paying attention to technicals is because we've gone through the fundamentals over and over. We know the fundamental story. We know intrinsic value. So now we just got to get through these supply pockets. But I think he also had a chart of natural gas, which looks like it's turning up here, pretty getting ready to go. So some of those natural gas stocks will start to make more sense. So this is kind of interesting. It's been bottoming for about a year and starting to turn up. So starting worth paying attention to that. Next, this is interesting. We've talked about in the past. This is from JC Parrott's, and this is the seasonality for the pre-election cycle versus what we've done so far year to date. So we had the rally up to July. Now you get some short-term weakness. I think you don't want to get too cute in this area. And this is what I'm talking about, because this is the indices. And the biggest weight, I think the contribution year to date from the Magnificent Seven was 74% of the performance of the S&P came from those seven stocks. So if you see the indices going sideways for the next few months and sideways choppy, all that means is that some of those Magnificent Seven are going to take a breather. And, I'm looking at Amazon after hours. Looks like they shot the lights out. That's great. We own it. Apple. Oh, that's iPad revs. Okay. Apple, I can't tell yet. Looks kind of flattish. But flattish would make sense, like we talked about with Charles. And then the other type of stocks that we've been focused on, which we've covered, you know, with dollar down, bonds up, multinationals, emerging markets and China and biotech. And then for the bonds, REITs, which have already started moved in a big way, banks and small caps. While this is going sideways, which is basically the Magnificent Seven, those can continue to rip higher. As a matter of fact, if you look at the IWM, it's kind of like, if you think about this blue line, it's kind of doing this and it's right up here. It's knocking on the door. And when it breaks out, we could get some continued strength in that rotation. All right, moving along. Not sure why I have to refresh all these, but this is from Seth Golden. Larry Williams, who's a technician. He's been around for a while. He's using this timing solution software. We have it. We've used it. I think he's been pretty good the last few years, you know, and historically, you know, he has his ups and downs, but it's been pretty good. And what his patterns are saying is the exact same thing as the seasonal cycle is saying, which is that the general indices go sideways. You get this kind of soft weakness, which is normal seasonality, October, September, some chop, some opportunity. But I wouldn't get too cute. For the stocks that haven't participated in the first half, if you're waiting for this dip, you have to keep in mind, this dip is basically the Magnificent Seven when you look at the weighting. And where's that money going? It's going to go to the ones that haven't yet performed. So if you're kind of waiting for this dip to buy the ones that haven't performed yet, they may be going up while this is going down. So don't get too cute with it, because there's going to be, while this looks flat, there's going to be a lot of progress under the surface for the right type of stocks. Next is from Seth Golden. You got, when S&P is up 10% through the first half of the year, second half return median is 12%+. So just going through that, average maximum drawdown is 6.7%. Most drawdown periods begin in July. And that's that. So it's just kind of confirming. Productivity in Q2 hit 3.7%, which is the highest level since Q3 of 2020. Very exciting. You know, things are really lining up very similarly to post Spanish flu, you know, 1918. And you all know that you have been with me. We made a ton of money in 2020 in those first 5-6 months, especially following that analog. And then we got the check back, which you had in, you know, 19 and 20. And then it was basically straight up during the 20s. So, you know, there's a lot of good stuff happening. Ryan Dietrich, 11 countries now have higher rated debt than the U.S. Did you know Australia now has the safest debt in the world? So this is what I referenced on CNA. The timing of this downgrade was silly, number one. And number two, if they're going to downgrade the U.S., there are many countries above. You're telling me United Kingdom is a better credit than the U.S. right now, given their economy, or Germany or France? Are you kidding me? You know, none of these, first of all, none of them are reserve currency. So they all have a higher potentiality to default than we do. But leaving that aside, this is silly season. So if these, you start to get a few downgrades, even if it's from a third tier rating company like Fitch, that's going to actually push money back into bonds. And I couldn't quite figure out when I was thinking about how could I be so clear that, you know, 10 year was going to get bid in the next 6 to 9 months. How would that happen without a recession was what I was trying to work through over the weekend, actually talking with a good friend of mine, Bill. And so this starts all the pieces of the puzzle. Sometimes you know how things are going to play out, but you don't know what's going to drive it there. And I think this is the perfect narrative to drive it there. Because if you remember from 2011, after the downgrade, 10-year yields compressed and equities rallied. So it could be a minor version. You know, 10-year yields went from 350 to 139, I think, and equities just totally took off from those fall lows and never looked back until, I think, 2015. Basically, it was a multi-year monster rally that didn't let anyone in. So first 1% decline after more than 2 months without one for the S&P 500. Since 1980, 1 year later, higher 26 out of 27 times and up 14.8% on average. I think that's in line with kind of our positive case going into the election. I think we get, you know, mid to high single digits on the indices through end of year and then move on. So next is PayPal and Generac. So these are two of our holdings, and I want to put this in perspective. First off, Generac powers down after earnings, consumer demand is softening. They actually beat revenue expectations, fell short on earnings, and disappointed with guidance. So their guidance expects net sales between 10 to 12% for the full year. Their previous guidance was a decline of 6 to 10%. So they got to work through some more inventory. So they're saying consumer environment were softer than previously expected. Here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. This is the most important player. If you remember from the interview he did on the Clayman Countdown that we played in recent podcasts, nothing's really changed with this story. If it's pushed out a few months, it's pushed out a few months. But let's just take a look at, you know, where the stock has been and where it's going. So you get a knee-jerk reaction. People ask me, did I buy more today? And the answer is I didn't buy more today because our basis is below here, I think, for most of the accounts. So this is just, you know, a normal, you get these, if you zoom out, you get a better view of how this stuff works, okay? So here it was 2015, 2016, the stock dropped 60% or whatever it was. You get these first couple rallies, and then you get these monster checkbacks, and then you start to take off to rebuild. It's the same thing here. We had this rally, we're checking back, we'll build the base, but we're coming out of the woods here, and I think this one is actually probably, hopefully it goes a little lower, and we can get some of the newer accounts in. This wasn't in mind to get into new accounts because it went from like 101 to 150 in a blink. But I think at these levels, we could get some exposure, which would be pretty exciting, and be very grateful for that opportunity. And then you had PayPal, and it's the exact same story last month. Everything's going up. Margins are going down because their non-branded business, the non-PayPal business, is growing like a weed, and they have lower margins. But it's a very... People think it's... defensive. It's actually an offensive move that they're doing. and it's going to be very good for the long term. Also, there was the problem that they didn't announce this new CEO. That'll be another catalyst. So we were in the market buying this today. So that was a complete no-brainer for us. You know, if it drops down into the 50s again, we'll pick up more. You know, it's got a value multiple. You know, it's trading at whatever it's trading at, 10, 11 times. And it's got a growth story. And they're generating cash like it's going out of style. And they've got 435 million users. This thing has a moat. Yes, it's a commodity business, but they have a special moat already established. And at these multiples, even if the fears of growth slowing are the case, it's already pricing the multiples. And if you get a reacceleration, which we believe is going to be the case, then you've got a stock that could be back up, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5x over the next 3 to 5 years. And this is something I want to participate in all day long. So market served up two generous opportunities. We intend to take advantage. And that's that. Moving on to China. Bulls look for, let's just see here, get you some color on PayPal. So they beat expectations on the bottom line. They beat expectations on the top line. Shulman showed confidence. Okay, so they just need the new CEO. So, yeah. But, by the way, it's interesting. The most negative guy was BTIG's Lance Jusum, but his he kept it at a buy with a $90 price target. Same thing with Bank of America came out, and Goldman came out defending the stock with buy ratings. So, we're comfortable with that one. And next one is China bulls look for redemption as Beijing shows policy resolve. So, you know, it's coming out in drips and drabs. I think I said it best on Charles Payne's show in that politicians, whether they're communist or democratic, they all eventually make the right decision after they've exhausted all other possibilities. And the perfect example with the communist China is that they resisted loosening their COVID restrictions until they had no choice. And with, you know, 20% of their 20-something-year-olds unemployed, they just don't know it yet. They have no choice. They're going to have to do bazooka stimulus, whether that's next week or in a month. It really doesn't matter. I'm not concerned. I got a couple questions. Is it coming? Number one, the economy is turning. So with or without stimulus, the thesis is intact. I think we're going to get a massive accelerant, and it's going to be all at once. Whether we need that to get to 120, or, you know, after it gets stuck at 120, all of a sudden you get the headline and that's what takes it up to 180. That would be the best case scenario. I think there's more than enough momentum going and juice in the tank to get to 120 without a bazooka. But they've already talked all of this. They just have to deliver it, and slowly but surely it's dripping out. China issues measures to bolster growth of consumer businesses, accelerate expansion of light industry, blah, blah, blah. So more and more stuff. They know they've got to act. They're trying to do as little as possible. And that's what they did with COVID. And eventually they had to do it all at once. China's cabinet urges cities to roll out property policies. Beijing signals it's not just all talk this time. Looks like, okay, China, stocks rally on policy rollout. They're taking concrete action. So that's that. China stopped short of direct consumer support to spur economy. People were looking for vouchers. That may come. They know what US and Europe did after they ended their lockdown to spur growth. They may have to do that themselves, and they can do it because they're facing deflation, Beijing's not inflation.
Planning agency to boost consumption.
Okay. China vows more economic support. And China stock rally holds promise as bullish indicators emerge. What are they talking about here? Broad participation, large and small, larger and smaller cap gauges alike seeing better breadth. Okay, so it's starting to broaden. We know that story from here. Hong Kong turnover hit 6-month high last week, it looks like. What date was this? August 1st, so this week. Okay. So that's positive. The Hang Seng broke out of this downtrend. That's positive. Oftentimes, when you break out of these downtrends, you tend to check back before you make the big move. We'll see if that happens this time. Overseas investors bought the most China stocks since January, so that's a positive thing. And I think that's all the indicators they've got. China's big tech companies revive expansion plans after Beijing vows to give the green light on more deals and ends the regulatory crackdown. They're starting to recruit again and hire again. Big tech enterprises remain some of the largest employers for the country's workforce of 880 million people. And then, okay, I don't know what that article was. Starbucks sees big rebound in China. And we saw the Wyndham fellow. And then you can also read about the MGM China. Alibaba Logistics arm rolls out half-day express delivery in 8 major cities as firms seek to help stimulate consumption. PBOC pledges more financial resources for private firms. China tech giant Alibaba challenges Meta with open-source AI model launch. This is a big deal. The stock was up a few percent today in a down tape. That was good to see. Moving on to the U.S. market. Bank of America, remember, they were the most negative. That at 3,600, they were saying we were going down another 27%, 20%. I won't name the person, but you know, you can Google it. The Mike Wilson of Bank America. And anyway, so she's now reversed her recession call. I don't know if they're using her or they have someone else. Usually when someone's wrong, they send another figurehead out to reverse the firm's position. Reversed recession call on strong jobs and spending. Consumers are employed and still spending money. CEO warns of risk proposed capital rules for big banks. Okay, so let us be, and there's not going to be a recession. China services activity surprisingly picks up in the private survey. I didn't hear this talked about at all today, but they actually beat on an economic data point today, which was nice to see. Strategists scramble to catch up as S&P 500 rally rumbles on. Oppenheimer took their target up to 4,900 this week. Mike Morgan Stanley's Wilson turned less bearish on Monday. Biogen, okay, we're seeing more big deals. Biogen just bought Reata Pharmaceuticals for $7.3 billion. So deals in drugs, ladies and gentlemen, it continues to roll on. What do we need? We need the Fed done. And then I think you're going to see it all at once. As a matter of fact, in Sloomer's slides, he does the second slide with Charles Payne where you see the sector groups and you can see the next group teed up to rock and roll are actually as interesting. In a major way, our payment processors, which would be PayPal based on where we are in the cycle. And the other big one that was teed up to rock and roll in perfect position, you can go back and look at it, is biotech. So we know this is going to happen. And when it happens all at once. We've seen it over and over again, and this time will be no different. Intel crushed it on Friday, by the way, jumped 7%. So that stock is actually holding in strong in a down tape. Very, very exciting to see. Remember when no one wanted it at $25? Now, no one still wants it at 35, which is exciting. I want no one to want it all the way up to 55 and then get some excitement going. And depending where they are in their foundries and all that stuff, maybe lay some off at 75 after a three bagger. Wharton Professor Jeremy Siegel says the stock market is headed to all-time highs thanks to strong economy and resilient corporate earnings. We agree. It's just a question of timeline, whether that happens before the end of the year or before the election. We'll see, but we're getting pretty close. I wouldn't expect any miracles in August and September, but then again, it wouldn't surprise me because every 3-5% dip has to be bought because managers missed the whole first half. Disney goes back to the future. He brought in two of his former era parents to turn around the linear business, the linear TV business. So that's positive. Third Point finally boosts their stock exposure this year, dated August 2nd. So they were very cautious the first half. Now they're getting exposure. BorgWarner second quarter results beat estimates on auto part demand. Yeah, we probably won't see Cooper until 6 o'clock. And then my guess will have a subdued call tomorrow, even if the numbers are great. So that, you know, we've covered that. U.S. Treasury increases borrowing estimate for third quarter to just over $1 trillion. I think this was a perfect time to get the downgrade in order to get this stuff done, because now the ratings agency can justify downgrading a couple other countries. Once they do that, everyone's going to say, well, the only place to go is the U.S. The bad news is you may get a short-term bid in the dollar as people come in to buy treasuries. But if you look back over the emerging market rallies and China rallies over the last 30 years, the key was that we came off the boil in October. You can have a rally in emerging markets, even if you're having counter trend rallies in the US dollar, once it's come off the boil. And now our base case is, you know, into the fall and next year, the dollar will weaken past this short-term consolidation range. But we have enough weakness now that emerging markets can go, whether or not the dollar continues to go down immediately. And you can just do an overlay, and maybe we'll cover that next week. I have it in my slides for the money show for Vegas on Tuesday. So for those going out, you'll get the first look at that. Article of the week, dumb money is the new smart money, stock market and sentiment results. So we covered that with Charles. You can see in this chart here, the last three times, the retail investor was buying when the institutional investor was scared, and the institutions didn't start playing catch up till the market was already up, in most cases, 30-40% off the lows, and the retail investor got all the juice out of the trade. And the same thing is happening this time. So you see it here in 2023, you see it in during the COVID lows, the retail investor was buying first, and you see it in the big dislocation in 2015 and 2016. The retail investor got the meat of the first part of the rally, and the institutions didn't catch up until it was at or near new highs. Here are some charts from Alibaba. Thanks to Ben and Rick for pulling these together for me last minute. You can see here the value of Alibaba, historic multiple of 23 times, trading at 11 times forward, two sigma below the 10-year average. And this is when you want to be a buyer, not a seller. Same thing with the Hang Seng. You'd have to go all the way back to 1998 to buy the Hang Seng at this low of a valuation relative to the rest of the world. And if you all remember, from that point to 2007 was the biggest rally in China and emerging markets in the history of their existence. And I think we're going to see something very similar to that 2002 to 2007 rally in the next 5 or 7 years. I'd say 5 years, actually. They tend to be abrupt and they tend to be quick. And based on China demography, I would say 3 to 5 years is a better look. Hang Seng's forward PE, we came off the October lows where it was trading at 7 times. It's now at 9.5. The mean is 10.81. And in these little moves in multiple expansion, you see big moves in stocks, multiple triple digit moves in some of the bigger names. This was the breaking down trend support. And then lastly, we were prepared to put out a new pick for Charles with Disney, but we ran short on time. That's only a 5-minute segment, that first few minutes, and there was some other stuff he had to cover. So I like putting out hated picks. I like buying high quality businesses when they're during periods of dislocation. That's what we do. We rinse, repeat. You do that over time, you do tremendously well. And Disney, in our view, is a rare opportunity to buy the highest quality asset while in the bargain bin. It fell 68% during the 2000 to 2002 recession. It fell 57% during the Great Financial Crisis. And this is the third chance to buy, having fallen 58% since 2021. So this third chance to buy a world-class franchise at 50% off, never. The other thing you want to keep in mind, you know, the big pushback I hear on Disney all the time is like, oh, go woke, go broke, and their content is too progressive. Look, first off, the good news is Bob Iger's in charge, and Bob Iger is a businessman. And if he figures out that the vast majority of his clients want to hear a different message, he's going to deliver. He's going to give the customer what they want. That I can guarantee you. So they will adapt. Maybe they swung the pendulum too far to one side or the other side. I don't know. All I know is this. They've got the most valuable content library in history. If you have a child and you don't have Disney, you know, social services will come and take you away. I mean, like, Like, every kid watches Disney. That's never going to change. They've got the most valuable park franchise and the most valuable IP, period. Nothing else exists. And you can get it at 50% off, and people are trading it like it's some, you know, low quality business with no franchise or brand equity. And it's just completely the opposite. So the park spend per person per capita is up 40% over 2019 levels. Iger extended his contract to 2026, so he's got enough time and runway to not only turn the ship around, but get a proper successor. And the move to get these two former heir apparents in place looks to be a step in that direction. That's Kevin Mayer and Tom Staggs. And then, you know, just looking forward at the numbers, you got 34% earnings growth next year, and then you got a five-year earnings growth rate of 21.26%. And that's probably very conservative based on a negative outlook right now. And I think you could find that this hockey sticks and they have to take numbers upward. So you benefit from once in 100-year weakness with the COVID. China parks are coming back strong. That's not even in the model, by the way. Cost cutting with a machete. They're cutting their spend on content with Star Wars and Marvel. And Unrivaled, we covered that. We think, you know, in the short term, the next couple of years, I think this is up 50 to 100%, maybe over 24 to 36 months. It's not going to be a super multi-bagger, but this is kind of an easy, sure thing that you can have a little higher than normal position size in our view. You got a bunch of catalysts in play. They're going to have a big analyst meet. I think they've got earnings on the 9th, but more important than that, they're going to have an analyst meeting in September and lay out their strategic outlook. They'll have more color on what they want to do with ESPN. And then second, robust theme park demand. Third, sports betting optionality at ESPN could be a big deal. Four, dividend could return by end of year after they do all these cost cuts. No one's really thinking about that. And then they bundle the Hulu, Disney Plus, and ESPN. They're buying the second half of Hulu that they don't have. That bundle will be good. And then they can do a cheap bundle and do the video on demand, as we've seen with Netflix, and start to get the margins cranking and get their subscribers even cranking more than they already have, which I think is 135 to 165 X India, which has 50. So, I mean, 200 million plus subscriptions is not something to shake a stick at. It's a big deal. So debt downgrade, we did that. PayPal update, we mostly did that. You can read through these notes on Bank of America and Goldman talking about actually what everything that was going right. You basically have a company trading at 10 times out earnings, and I think these earnings are far too low in terms of what's going to be happening moving forward. This should be trading at 20 times at least, and these earnings are too low is our view as you look out 24 to 36 months. And then Cooper Standard, as I said, they report tonight, conference call tomorrow, and JP Morgan Auto Conference next Thursday. Finally, seasonality. This is from Slumer over at RBC. You know, we know this, everyone knows this, which is interesting. Everyone knows that seasonality is weak in August and September. It's almost consensus now, which starts to make me think it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, usually when everyone's looking for correction is when you don't get it. That would probably be a surprise at this point because everyone needs one, right? If you consider most managers have been underweight equities all year long, they had terrible first halves, you know, probably up 3 to 5% while the benchmarks are up 18%. We were up multiples of that, which is pretty damn exciting, multiples of the benchmarks. And so, you know, at the maybe they get lucky and they get 3 to 5% pullbacks that they can put money to work, but expecting a lot more than that, I think, is a little bit too optimistic. And I think the pain trade would actually be higher and give them no place to get in like in 2020. Although you did get a little consolidation sideways in June, July, August in 2020, but it barely let them in. I mean, it was just these mini pullbacks. So they still have the high cash level, still taking the lowest amount of risk. And this is from a week ago, the lowest amount of risk since March 2009, which basically was the lows. Retail's gotten a little bit too giddy, so maybe knock some wind out of their sails. But these things can stay pinned on the first move coming out of a big heart attack like you saw in the fall of last year. So just keep an open mind. The key is forget predicting the market and find quality businesses that are marked down. And if you buy them today and they go down another few points, you can buy more. But if you think about it in the scheme of 2 or 3 years, what you don't want is that they run away from you and then you can't get it. You had one chance to buy a great business at 50% off. Like, who cares if you missed getting it at 55% off? Like, what's the difference if it's going to be a double? And that's how you have to think about it. Good businesses when they're on sale. So after being highly exclusive since 2019, close to new investors prior to that, our business is expanding to serve an additional tier of new clients. The response we've received since opening up in the past few weeks has dramatically exceeded our expectations. We covered that a little bit earlier. If you missed this round, don't sweat it. Still put in your contact us if you're interested. We expect to reopen in the next 45 to 60 days. And many of you have already gotten sent in your subscription agreements and you're ready to go. And as soon as we turn on the green light, we'll accept the next batch. We're still deploying the recent capital that came in and we'll be ready to go with the new batch. So if you're interested, get on the wait list, click the link here, enter your information, we'll chat and see if it's a fit. And then you should be good to go in the next couple of months. Moving along, exploration and production. Earnings, top 30 weights, earnings power. Again, this is why we've been cautious on energy since last year. Earnings power is down 6.45% in the last 60 days, 5.22 for next year. So it's got to be very special. And again, it's got to be natural gas in our view. This is industrials top 30 weights. Earnings are basically flat, down 59 bips and 30 bips for 2023 and 2024 respective. So there's opportunity there. Started looking at Honeywell, actually, not doing anything yet. Some of these defense stocks, 3M, of course, we love. And that's about it in that group at the moment. Earnings estimates actually turned up last week. They were kind of hovering around 245. They're back up to 246. It'll be interesting to see what happens. So it looks like Apple's a little flattish, down a point after hours, but Amazon is still up bigly. So that's great because we don't own Apple and we do own Amazon. And we also own Alphabet. So as far as the Magnificent Seven goes, some data points. The JOLTS came down, so that's good for the Fed. But today we had the jobless claims came in less than expected. So you know, the economy's hot. The GDP now is at 3.9%. Continuing claims came in line with expectations. Unit labor costs came down. That's good. So we'll see the jobs report tomorrow. That's going to be another big deal. Earnings. Okay, let's get to the Ask Me Anything questions. We've got quite a few this week. Valerio Marco Pomoni says, great job of yours. It is really inspiring. What are your thoughts about Kohl's? In February, they refused a $64. February 2022, they refused a $64 acquisition offer. It's interesting. I played golf with a guy who turns around businesses in this space. And he's very sanguine on this one and on Dillard's. But Dillard's is already run. And he's turned around some big name brands that you know. Let's take a look here. Got a few of these set up. So Kohl's. And where is the stock charts thing? All right, let's pull this over. Our PayPal and Generac, everyone panicking and giving us an opportunity to buy some more. All right. Let's see here. Okay. K-O-H. Gosh, I haven't looked at Kohl's in a while. KSS. I was like, I know that's not the ticker. Yeah. All right. So KSS. All right. So it's rallied. It's basically doubled off the bottom. But you know, potentially has some more to go. The stock's done nothing in 23 years. Why has it done nothing in 23 years? I'll bet it's because It's a low-quality business that barely compounds capital in the mid-single digits. It's a grind business with low margins, sales declining. Yeah, you can say, you know, it'd be like the Macy's people saying, oh, it's a real estate play, it's a real estate play. Well, you know, they're putting pickleball courts in all the malls, so I'm not sure how valuable the real estate is for big boxes in B malls. But I think at best this is a trade. You know, this sounds like, what are they, Sephora? So store within a store. God, this sounds like JCPenney. So I don't really care if someone offered them $65 or $64. My guess is, Valerio, is that, you know, it was probably interesting at $20 for a trade up to $45, $50 and then get the hell out. So you're at 30 now, your risk reward changes. Do you really want to take risk for 50%? It could happen probably pretty quick. It's not for me. This is not a quality business that I want to own long-term. Same thing with Lumen Technologies. He says they manage debt. They have, this is the old CenturyLink. The problem with these businesses, it's like Credit Suisse. Unless you fire everyone, the culture is there's something wrong with the culture of certain businesses. And no matter how good the prospects are, the people find a way to screw it up. And that's what I found with CenturyLink over the years. Same with Frontier. There's just something wrong. They can't figure it out. They can't get out of their own way. They look cheap. Maybe you get these multi-bagger trades. These are like meme stocks, basically. Lumen. You know, they had to change the name so people would forget what a bag of garbage this was. I mean, it's trading like it's going bankrupt. I don't buy like businesses like this. Yeah, it could be a five bagger, but you could also have a goose egg. So if you're going to trade it, you have to trade it so small that it's not even going to make an impact if it's a 1 or 2% position. Revenue's down 25% in the last few years. Losing money. How's the cash flow? Okay, cash from operations declining materially. It's down 66% in the last few years. They sold something to get some cash. Divestiture here. It looks they sold for $8 billion, so that's good. But they're not going to have another one of those net change. So they made, after making $8 billion on a sale, they only added $48 million of cash and had negative $655 million of free cash flow. I mean, this thing, it's trading like it's going bankrupt because with $411 million of cash and $19 billion of long-term debt, there's probably a decent chance they are going to go bankrupt. So if they don't go bankrupt, you'll get a five bagger. But like, who wants to take that risk reward? I mean, go trade Tupperware. Tupperware, we had an unbelievable trade on during COVID because there were different people involved. And the one reason it did not become a long-term trade was when I became aware that the people who were, the new people that were involved have no concept of how that business works. That, like, I'm not gonna really point people out, but like, you know, I think, I'm guessing now, like, I think we traded that from like 6 to 20 and got out, and then it collapsed down to 60 cents. And now some people are buying it at 60 cents to $6. I think it could be toast because the minute you go multi-channel with that business, you lose the sales force. And then you just have a piece of plastic in a store, competing with other pieces of plastic that are, you know, 0.2 times the price of what yours is. So they don't get that business. That business is all about the story and the person-to-person sales, and they destroyed it. So, cause they have short-term thinking and they couldn't get their mind around through COVID. But I spoke to them and I got, you know, I just clearly understood that they did not understand the business. And that was clearly evidenced by the decisions that they've made recently. So take it for a trade if you want, but just know, same with Lumen, you're just gambling is basically it, because if it works, you make a multi-bagger, but if it doesn't, you get zero. And, that's not the game I want to play. But good questions. I think your framework is correct. You're looking at cheap value. The problem is those are cheap for a reason. Lomé Vandamme. So I think that was Italy. And this one looks like the Netherlands. Yeah, here we go. Most recently discovered your podcast and YouTube videos while searching for more content on Alibaba. Look forward to your material every week. As a European in the Netherlands and our currency being in euros, I purchased Alibaba ADRs, which are denominated in US dollars. You keep mentioning that weakening dollar should be good for emerging markets, hence for Alibaba. Although Alibaba stock going up in price would be good news, the weakening dollar against the euro could also have a negative effect on my investment results. Any concrete and inexpensive suggestions for hedging the currency dollar risk? How would you go about it? Accept the currency risk or hedge it? I would accept the currency risk because, you know, if you have a stock that's going to be up, you know, another 200% from here over the next few years, and you lose 20% on currency, it's not a big deal. And you could also, well, buying in Hong Kong, I don't think helps you. I wouldn't get cute with hedging because even if the dollar stayed flat, Alibaba could do perfectly fine from here. What we needed in October was it for it to stop going up, and that's what happened, and that's why the stock bottomed. So good question. Thanks and welcome. Martin Floriani. Thanks, Tom, for sharing your investment philosophy, which I share to the core as a loyal reader and subscriber. What do you think of Tyson? It's still trading near its 2018 lows, about 40% off its two-year high. Price to book is 1. Price to sales is 0.37. Cash flows are down versus prior years, largely driven by stock repurchases and restructuring. They've been through downturns and always seem to correct over time. Sector should also benefit from expected lower feed prices and potentially higher meat prices due to lower supply. Martin Floriani. Let's take a look. That one might be interesting. That tends to be a very cyclical business, so it's probably more of a trade here as well, but higher quality than the ones we've looked at so far. I think I pulled the Tyson. So the cash flow per share is halved. Their earnings are down 60%. This is just in the last few years. Stock's only down 50%. Book value doesn't, I don't really care. Usually trades at 14 times, so it's trading at less than 10 times. But again, you know, here's a business that can't compound capital. I mean, historically it was a double digit. Focused on achieving profitable growth. You know, it's all perception, right? So you have a stock that was a 30 bagger from the 2009 lows, and now it's just pulled back half. I mean, I like to be buying them when everyone hates them in these levels versus after they've had these monster runs and they pull back a little and they look a little cheap, but historically it's a low quality business. I think you're probably going to be okay, but I would just look for a better business. There's so much to do, like chasing the garbage to try to get a little bit of excess returns. This is not a garbage business, but it's not a great business. I would just need to get comfort in what is their turnaround plan. So that requires listening to 4 or 8 conference calls, reading the quarterlies and annuals for the last 2 years, looking at other periods where they were down 50% and kind of how management talked about their turnaround plans then and how they tracked to what they actually did versus what they said. Let's take a look at their balance sheet. $500 million of cash, $7 billion. So they paid down some debt. Cash from operations pretty steady. It's probably okay. I would probably be a pass without doing a lot more work myself. But you're probably okay. I think your framework is okay. I just don't think there's enough margin of safety for me to risk any capital on it. Like if this thing was trading at $20 or $25, I'd be super interested, but up here, I'm less interested. Martin Crumlish, not worried about my position in BABA at all. We've had a great run over the last few weeks. I'm curious about your thoughts on Chinese stimulus announcements. There's been very little in the way of substantive measures, mostly window dressing to beef it up in sentiment, it seems. What are your thoughts on the stimulus side of the equation at Do you think they're going to continue to suck their thumb? A bullish on substantial policy. Yeah, we covered that on Charles Payne. They're going to have no choice. It's just a question of when. You've got 20% youth unemployment. All you need is a couple million of those in the streets, and you get the bazooka overnight, just like you got the unlocked them out of their apartments overnight when they started rioting. So whether they'll do it proactively or reactively is immaterial. The question is they're going to be forced to do it, and it's just a question of when. I think they already realize that based on how they're languaging. And I think that they are actually taking some actions, and the market just doesn't believe it because it's been so much talk and so little action. But just note, like with the COVID unwinding the lockdowns, when they do it all at once, and it's big, and you'll wake up, and if you missed it, you missed it. And Rick Borax, longtime follower, first time AMA. Vodafone, a beat down European African telecom. I feel like I'm reaching with this one as financials look mixed, but with new management and a new game plan, I wonder if there's some possibilities here at these prices. Throw in an ongoing merger with VOD being the parent. Seems like it could be interesting. By the way, always happy to share your content. Keep it coming. All the best, Rick. All right, Vodafone. You know, this is basically like AT&T and Verizon. Here's another stock that's done nothing for 23 years. Low quality business, a lot of debt. Free cash flow. Take a look. I think I pulled it on Value Line just to do it quickly here. Trading at 7x earnings, historically trades at 9. Earnings are starting to improve. Cash flow is increasing. Revenues are improving. Debt is getting paid down slowly. This has always been a low single digit compounder. So that would probably be negative for me, but I think you probably have the basis for a trade here. But I mean, you know, it's $9. So what are you going to do? You're going to trade it up to 17 or 18 bucks and get out? You can do that. I mean, that'll probably work as a trade, but I think there are better ways to spend your time, but I think it's okay. Stacy B, many thanks for providing your opinions and market research information every week in these videos. I've been following you for nearly a year now, and I'm so grateful for finding your website and channel. Please, I would like to hear your thoughts on Deva, a software company based in London. As I know you've mentioned, looking into having European UK exposure. Company is cash flow positive and has been growing revenues and a customer base consistently over the years, yet stock more than 70% off December 21 highs, rallied off the June 23 lows, but has since pulled back. Thank you for your time, Stacy. Okay, Stacy B, let's have a look. Dava. D-A-V-A. I guess that's Endava. Okay, so this probably doesn't have enough financial information for me to get excited about. I haven't seen how they operate through cycles. But let's have a look anyway. Maybe some of these services will have the pre-public information from the prospectus. Yeah. All right. Gross margins are staying up. Cash flow has been growing. Revenues have been growing. Big compounders of capital. Revenues are growing. Like a weed. Gross profit, operating income. Okay, are there any bucks 68? Oh, let's just. Cash flow. Positive cash from operations and growing. Free cash flow is positive. Margins are hanging in there. I can't find any problems with it. So now I would have to understand the business and do some work on that. What do they do? Provide technology services, healthcare modality, retail verticals, digital advisory service for payments, financial service, TMT, and collaborative, cloud engineering. So yeah, this is probably worth understanding because it looks interesting. It's showing, looks like there's some support here. This is probably worth a look. I can't say yes. I can't find anything wrong with this, so it's definitely worth a look. I would get on, start to pull some of the data from their investor relations. Let's see here. Investors. Digital entertainment. Acquisition. Here's the reason. Okay, so here's the most recent presentation from May. So I'd go through this investor presentation, then start to work on the public filings and understand the business. What's the mode? Who are their competition? Who is their competition? Who's management? What have they, you know, accomplished before this? How long have they been running it? But on a pure numbers basis, there's nothing not to love here. So I think you might have found one worth looking into pretty seriously, Stacy. Good work. Vinod Nimaguda. Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for sharing your content in audio video podcast. I have started watching your podcast from the last 6 to 8 weeks. You've helped many of us with great insights on many of your picks, specifically Baba Diz, PayPal. Wish you to continue to share information. I'm not near your $1 million cutoff to be a customer. Question. What is your suggestion and thought process on scaling up and positioning? What would you consider in terms of percentage for a tiny position, a large position, general views, thesis, thoughts on Constellation? Small positions, usually 5 or 6%. There'll be a few exceptions where I do smaller, but that would be small. I don't really scale up. I would scale down. So if I buy a high quality business and then I can, and the market serves up an opportunity to buy it at better prices and nothing's changed with the underlying thesis or fundamentals, I will buy. But when it starts to move in my direction, I don't chase after it and buy up because I'm excited that my stock position's going up. The battles are won before the war, and I know where I'm getting out of the stock before I enter the stock. And the only thing that'll change where I get out is if the fundamentals get better in the meantime and there's no basis for getting out at the level I thought would become that be fair value based on how the business was doing when I entered it. If the numbers come in better than I expected they would, which often happens because I'm buying it when sentiment is at its lowest, then I might hold it longer than I expected. But I usually size position exactly what I want at the beginning and then I'll add at the margins if the market serves up opportunities in the short term. Robert Freeman, what's your current take on silver and gold commodities given the recent U.S. credit downgrade? Well, I don't know. I have no view on the big. This is not what I do. I buy productive assets that throw off cash. I'll just take a look, but it's kind of useless for you. Let me just see something. Oh, it's GLD if I remember. Yeah. All right. So all the technical people will say this is a cup and handle. Therefore, it's going to 294. SLV. Let's see what the commercials are doing here. That's what I would care more about than anything else. Gold. So they've been selling. Yeah, I mean, commercials actually works better for some instruments than other. Apparently, it does not work well for gold. I have no idea. I think this is just gambling. I'd rather buy productive assets that I can have an edge on. And if gold's going up because of inflation or some other reason, if gold's going up because the world's ending, I'd rather own U.S. Treasuries, long end of the curve. And if gold is going up due to inflation, I'd rather own high quality businesses that are compounders. And the reason they're compounders is because they have a moat and they have pricing power. And while you make double on gold, I'm going to make 3x on a high quality business. So it's not for me. Andrew Lair, by the way, it doesn't mean it's not for you. It could be perfectly well for you, and you may have a better edge on whether the price of silver or gold or, you know, Tupperware is going up or down. Those are just gambling instruments as far as I'm concerned. Andrew Lair, thank you for all of your great work. I was going to ask you about Disney per your article of the week, but it looks like you already like it. Instead of asking about a specific company, could you talk about other decision-making biases you are consciously aware of? I know you talk about avoiding errors of commission. Are there others you focus on? Recency bias, hindsight bias, etc. We talked about recency bias a lot. You can basically learn all these frameworks in a short time. FS, let's see, Farnham Street. Let's see, I think they're all here. Mental models. So you just go to fs.blog. And then you have this whole tutorial on all 100 mental models explained, and you can learn them in a pretty quick time and unwrap a lot of blind spots at the same time. So, and they're worth a continuous review. That's a good question. Here's a good answer that can help everyone. Dante Nesperoli. Hi, Thomas. Thanks for all you do. My question is concerning Citibank. As you mentioned, the weakening dollar means opportunity for businesses with more than 50% of revenue outside the U.S., which Citi has. It's also trading substantially below book value, but more importantly, it's below its historic 10-year price to book. What are your thoughts on buying Citi with a 24-month investment horizon? We agree, and we bought it in some of the newer accounts because Bank of America, which we bought in March, already took off and we don't chase up. So we bought Citi, and I think the best catalyst that could happen for Citi, and basically it's a play on the investment banking, is going to come back in spades over the next 12 months, and it's going to be a money machine. They still need a change of management, and I think if you saw a change of management, the stock would be up, you know, probably 30% overnight, and then you get the banking on top of it, and you get the tailwinds of all of that, and you get the big banks getting bigger. And you're going to have a win. So we like that for a long-term position, Dante, and we're with you on that. Nice work. And that's it. Wow. Okay. So with that said, I want to thank everyone for tuning in this week. It's been great. If you liked it, share it with a friend. Comment, like, and subscribe to the YouTube channel, Hedge Fund Tips. You just put it in the search bar. Thank you once again. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. In the meantime, make a great one. Bye for now.